From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. When Kanye West speaks, only Jesus knows what you'll hear these days.
When you hear about slavery for 400 years, for 400 years, that sounds like a choice. Like, you was there for 400 years and it's all of y'all?
So what did Kanye mean when he said slavery's a choice? We'll ask our break room panel as we discuss all the week's news, like restricting service animals on airline flights, if male accusers accusers of sexual harassment deserve more of a voice these days. And yes, we're going to talk about that Brian Kemp for governor ad, cha-chunk. That's all ahead this hour. But first, we talked earlier this week about organ donations. A new study from Johns Hopkins University finds that 1 in 8 organ transplants in the United States these days involves organs that are coming from someone who died of a drug overdose. Dr. Christine Durand worked on that study.
We did, in fact, find that patients who received transplants from donors who died from an overdose had excellent outcomes. They were the same or, in many cases, even better than organ transplants from donors who died from trauma or donors who died from medical causes.
Here are your first thoughts. We got this call from Anna in Savannah. She used to be an ICU nurse and took care of people donating organs and those receiving them.
It's such a wonderful, compassionate gift that the families of the donor have decided to do. And in every single case I've been a part of, they were always so thankful that amongst this tragedy, their decision to donate created new life for a person. So I just wanted everyone to consider being an organ donor because, again, if a tragedy does happen, at least something positive can come out of this.
Well, listeners, we always want to know what you think. You can call us like Anna did at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to our Facebook page and we might feature your comments on the show. My first guest today is Obie Brown, a journalist who has covered Middle Georgia for almost 4 decades. Today is his last day at the Telegraph in Macon, Georgia, where he has worked for nearly his entire career and where, for a few more hours at least, he is the senior editor. In recent months, the paper has seen an exodus of veteran staffers. Some exits have been more willing than others. This is a story that we could tell about any hometown paper in Georgia. But hey, Macon is my town. Since I arrived here 6 years ago to work with Mercer University's Center for Collaborative Journalism, in which the Telegraph is a partner, I've personally seen the newsroom shrink, by my count, by about half. And it was already far down from its peak power. I think a lot of people in Macon see the loss of Obie Brown as a major turning point for their local paper, and we're going to get back to that. But first, let's celebrate this man's career and tap his knowledge about everything that he has seen over 4 decades. Welcome, Obie Brown.
Thank you, Adam. Glad to be here.
Go back to the beginning. How'd you get in the biz?
Well, I was at the University of Georgia, and just mainly a series of English courses. I had the professor pull me aside and basically say, you've got a nice touch on some of your papers, and I liked it, and just kind of evolved from there. I just I graduated from high school and was in college, you know, right post Watergate era. So that was, you know, it's just a confluence of the two, really. So
heyday for American newspapers.
Yeah, really
for
was.
Sure.
Really was.
Your first newspaper job was at the Telegraph?
First newspaper job was at a little weekly in a bedroom community in Paulding County, the Paulding County neighbor. It was an outpost of the Marietta Daily Journal and was there for a year. I actually taught school for a year, then came home, and Telegraph had an opening, and I got it. So, yeah.
You remember your first day? Do you remember the first story you covered?
You know, I don't. I remember... oddly, one of the first weekends I covered, the first few years happened to be Tuesday through Saturday shifts. I remember there was a great man named Cleeter Metters, worked at Clay, very, very well known in those circles. And there was a kind of like Fired Works. It was a show, a little gathering down in Perry. And I went down there and just spent time talking to him about his craft and what he did. And, you know, before I left, bought one of his coffee mugs that he had signed on the bottom of it, which I still have. You know, it's it was great. But he was just a great old fella.
Back when papers had resources to send somebody to go cover a ceramics show.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
1983, you covered a huge story. The Supreme Court had suspended all executions in the United States from 1964 to 1976. And then in 1983, John Eldon Smith became the first Georgia inmate to be executed since the reinstatement of the death penalty. And you were there as a witness. That's something they do. They have media witnesses. Tell us about what that was like. I mean, you were young. You were really early in your career.
Well, I was. I'd been at the Telegraph for 3 years. As it happened, the execution was scheduled 10 days before Christmas. So it was the holiday season. I was way down the pecking order to I raised my hand to witness it. And as it got closer to the time, folks didn't want to go. So I went on December 15th, 1983, got up there early.
Yeah.
And again, this was pre, you know, Macon.com didn't launch till 96. So this was, it was early in the morning, so I could come back and write the story.
Yeah.
But afterward, covering a couple more executions, phoned them in from a truck stop there. back in the day, but it was tough. You know, I was young, and you're in a small room, and you're right there watching an execution. It's it had a profound effect on me, actually, and still talk about it with people today and do remember it. But it just happened that a Bibb County case happened to be the first one once the death penalty was reinstated in a Bibb County case. So
you say it had a profound effect on you. I've described you, OB, as old school in the best sense of the word. As a young whippersnapper in the field, there's lots of things about old school journalism and newspapering that I don't really miss. I don't really mourn. But like, you are everything that is good about the old school. And one of the things about you that I imagine is that you probably would be reticent to express your personal feelings about controversial issues, kind of like capital punishment. What was it like having an experience like that? That probably gave you a lot of things to think about with regard to your personal values, and not really having to bottle up a lot of those feelings in order to do your job as a reporter, an old school reporter.
Well, it did. I remember coming home that day, and it was a long day, but I stopped by the store, and I just remember at one point, it was an old Piggly Wiggly store near Pierce Avenue, and I just remember stopping dead in my tracks and just staring at people, basically the shoppers. It was odd, and I don't know how long I stood there and stared, but I imagine it was some kind of post-witness episode. But I just tell you, the newsroom and all the good folks there are very much they're a tonic and a very therapeutic back in the newsroom. They can they can snap you back to attention in the real world very, very quickly. So that was a great salve for me, being back in the newsroom and just being able to share and describe what it was like. So,
sure.
Yeah.
We're talking to OB Brown. He is working his last day as senior editor of the Telegraph newspaper in Macon, the paper where he's worked for nearly all of his nearly four-decade career. The Telegraph is seen an exodus of top people in recent years for all of the same market reasons that are affecting newspapers everywhere. But I think it's fair to say everybody in Macon feels like the loss of OB Brown hurts particularly so. But let's go back and hit another career highlight before we talk about the sad stuff. About 10 years ago, you covered, boy, one of the big ones for the paper. And in fact, you've brought in the actual paper. I've got it right here. Rattle it for people. In July of 1994, Tropical Storm Alberto devastated Macon and other parts of central Georgia. Flooding and other destruction from the storm left 31 people across the state dead. Close to 300,000 people were without running water for several weeks. Hundreds of thousands of people, no water for weeks. Here is a clip from the Telegraph's one-time archenemy, WMAZ-TV in Macon.
Now, the truck went in across Rocky Creek Road last night during raging waters. The couple was allegedly out just joyriding and hit this drainage ditch. And the truck, of course, was swept away. It made it all the way under Rocky Creek through the torrents of water. And as you see now, they are trying to pull the victim from the truck.
Was that Liz Fabian?
That sounds like Liz. What a jewel.
She was TV reporter at the time, but now a reporter at the Telegraph. Right. Boy, what'd you make of that story?
Yeah, it was such a hard story. No water for 3 weeks. We would, again, this was 94. Still kind of analog days in a lot of ways. And I just remember, you know, you've got a big story and you hug, kiss your family goodbye, and you come in and you just work it basically until you drop. Had water distribution areas all over town, but there was so much. I remember we had it started raining the night of July 4th, and we had a hamburger cookout at my house, and it ended early because it started raining, and it just would not stop raining. So it rained pretty much for 3 days, and it just, of course, that caused a lot of problems here downstream Lake Tobosoffke, and it was you just couldn't imagine the way waters rose. It was just mind-boggling.
And this is in the days before Facebook, when people could have talked to each other about where you can get who's got bottled water.
Get across the river at this point?
Right.
How do I even try to get in? Do I go to work? Can I get to work? How do I go? You know,
The paper was the only way that people knew, and so, you know, you must have been exhausted by the end of that.
Well, I remember people we were dealing back home, my wife Linda. We would grab water however we could. We would run some water, trying to make do. But finally, the paper we found. I remember we found a motel in Forsyth, and everybody, you know, we went up there basically to take a shower. I guess we were tired of being around each other after many days, and that was such a joy. You know, the simple joys just. Going to this place and taking a quick shower. I do remember that, because you just could not do that here for 3 weeks. So,
but of course, Facebook and everything else like it has utterly decimated the business model of newspapers and hometown papers everywhere, shrinking precipitously. I think the latest Bureau of Labor Statistics data indicates the number of people employed by newspapers is down by about 70%, I think, from its peak in the late 90s or early 2000s. In the last minute that we have here, Obi, how have you seen the industry change in recent years? Where do you think it's headed? Where do you think Telegraph is headed?
Well, hard to do in a minute. Clearly, we are in the midst of a sea change, both in our newsroom and everywhere else. There's a great article lately in The Atlantic about Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg, and basically, you know, beyond the news feed and what's emphasized, you know, he runs a media company that decided to show less local news, seems to value opinions more than feeds from professional news outlets. I don't know. I'm curious how it will play out. I am a little worried about context and depth of reporting, the time to do that, but it will sort itself out. There are great people in the newsroom, and I've been proud to stand shoulder to shoulder with them for all these years. I've been blessed to work with great people.
Obi Brown, senior editor for a few more hours at the Telegraph newspaper in Macon. Today is his last day. All hail the conquering hero, Obi. We love you.
Thank you, Adam.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. is certainly a person who comes to mind when you think of the civil rights movement, but many other people contributed, including some unsung heroines, like Georgia Gilmore. She cooked for King and other civil rights leaders. Here she is in an interview for PBS's Eyes on the Prize.
I served them food and everything, and Reverend King was one of, and Reverend Abernathy, and Reverend Powell and all, but Reverend King, most of all, was just like a member of my family, because the very things that I needed, he helped me to obtain them, and nobody but he and I today know about them.
Gilmore's cooking went a step further. She organized the Club from Nowhere, which baked food to help fund the Montgomery bus boycott. Public radio producers Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson explored Gilmore's contributions to the movement for NPR. They are the hosts of the podcast The Kitchen Sisters Present, and you can meet them in Atlanta Monday for Radiotopia Live East Coast, a staged event featuring different podcasters. By now, you've probably heard that On Second Thought is welcoming a new host. Her name is Virginia Prescott, and she recently sat down with the Kitchen Sisters to talk about Georgia Gilmore's life and work.
Georgia started working out of her home after she was fired from a lunch counter where she was working. Now, why was she fired? Let's hear from Nikki.
Well, she was working at the National Lunch Counter as a cook, and it was right about the time when Rosa Parks began all the back of the bus, and the bus boycott was just starting up, and she began taking part in the bus boycott, and the folks at the National Lunch Counter found out about it and fired her at that time because she was taking part in the boycott.
Davia, what was she doing for the boycott?
An array of supportive activities, solidarity activities with the bus boycott, combination of continuing to honor the boycott, not going to the back of the bus herself, and then sort of agitating within the community for support of the boycott, which was a really expensive endeavor and a real hardship for people because they would have to, you know, the bus was the main transportation for people to their jobs across Montgomery. And so pretty quickly she got involved and created what she called the Club from Nowhere, which was women baking pies and cakes, and they were being sold out of gas stations and out of beauty parlors and all around town. And she was spearheading that because, as her son says, she was a stone cook. And she got, and it was also a way of a lot of white women who wanted to be supportive of the boycott but weren't out on the lines there. They would buy these pies and cakes, and that would help money and people, that would be able to make people be able to afford taxi cabs, kind of this unofficial taxi network that was created, and also to put gas in the tanks of cars that were ferrying people to their jobs so people could hold on to their jobs and boycott the bus system.
Here's a little clip of Georgia Gilmore speaking in a 1986 interview for the PBS series Eyes on the Prize about the Club from Nowhere.
And so the Club from Nowhere was able to report maybe 150, 125, or 75, or maybe $200 or more a week, and which was very nice of the people, because so many of the people who didn't attend the mass meeting would give the donations to help keep the carpool going.
Wow. It's a pretty significant way to fuel the boycott. Well, how did they come to be called the Club from Nowhere?
I think everybody needed anonymity. A lot of people, especially the white people who were being supportive of the boycott and this whole, I mean, thinking about it now through the lens of history now, and you think about women and women supporting each other, and a lot of these women couldn't probably defy their husbands and couldn't defy the convention in an overt way of segregation. But here through, you know, going to your beauty parlor and taking a cake home or a slice of pie, suddenly you were helping fuel the boycott. So I don't know exactly why they picked Nowhere, I think, but it was also sort of that it was stealth, and also these, you know, they were forming a club. They were clubs with every kind of name in Alabama, and this was sort of one of the ultimate sort of secret societies.
How did that funding, that $150, $200 a week, stack up against others raising funds for the movement?
I don't know the answer, but, you know, there were the station wagons and gasoline for the station wagons that were going around and picking people up and taking them to work. I mean, they needed alternate transportation to get to their jobs throughout the city. And, you know, it was an expensive endeavor for people to say, oh, yes, I'll drive people. They needed the gas and they needed the station wagons, and they needed the, you know, way to augment their income in order to, you know, ferry people around the town to keep the boycott alive.
I think there were fundraisers going on up and down the East Coast, around the country, helping support this boycott. I know it was a really engaged civil rights movement, and Dr. King was a new minister in town, and so he was the one ultimately who had the idea to stake Georgia to a restaurant in her home, a little hidden kitchen, and it was the first integrated dining space in Montgomery, Alabama. She was cooking out of her kitchen, her living room, her dining room, her porch, all of those were where people would congregate and come to eat. She was feeding a lot of the workers in the state building. She was the one making lunches and bringing over. She was such a phenomenal entrepreneur, you know, and so deeply committed politically, and those two things combined. And she was a single mother with many children. So she was inventing and reinventing ways to support herself, to support the movement.
With the encouragement and help of Dr. King, who loved her food.
Yeah, there's a clip from your podcast, This is the Kitchen Sisters Presents, of Reverend Nelson Mauldin. He's describing the relationship between Georgia Gilmore and Dr. King.
Reverend King, when he came to Montgomery, I was his flesh barber. Whenever VIPs would come to town, he would always have Ms. Gilmore to cook up a batch of chicken. When she was fired from a restaurant, Reverend King said, well, why don't you go in business for yourself?
So she was cooking for Reverend King and his guests, but also there were meetings being held in her hidden kitchen. What was going on at those meetings?
Yeah, it seemed, I mean, when we do our stories, part of the reason we did the Hidden Kitchen series was we look for the universals between people, the things you don't know that you have in common that might make somebody not be your enemy, that gives you a way in. And I think that space that Georgia created by cooking out of her house, by it being off the beaten path, people who might never be in conversation before opened up her amazing cooking and that kind of privacy that they had, even though it was in plain sight if you were really looking for it. But I think it let, you know, many presidents came, Johnson came, Kennedy came, people came to that kitchen of hers to talk about things and to cross lines together. She was so connected to the state building, too, that a lot of those higher officials in Montgomery of the time would come there. And I think conversations that might never have been possible in a conference room or in a more confrontive situation were made possible over her fried chicken, over her hog maw.
She loved to cook and she loved to curse, is one of the things that we learn about Georgia Gilmore from your podcast. This is not a woman who was celebrated in the way that a Rosa Parks was. What do we get when we understand the roles of people like Georgia Gilmore in the civil rights movement?
Dr. King always called that group of people the ground crew. And I think he knew he could not do his work without that ground crew around him.
Also, one of the things that always kind of struck me was just she was doing all this big work in terms of the civil rights movement, but at the same time, she was inspiring people like Martha Hawkins, another young woman cook who, because of Georgia, started her own restaurant and called Georgia and asked her for advice, and she sort of freely gave it and encouraged her to follow her dreams. And I just feel that's such an important part of it, is helping pull people up along with you.
Those were Public Radio producers Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson, hosts of the Kitchen Sisters podcast. They spoke to On Second Thoughts' Virginia Prescott. You'll be hearing a lot more from Virginia for sure. She is On Second Thoughts' new host. And you can meet the Kitchen Sisters in Atlanta Monday. They'll be in town for the Radiotopia Live East Coast Tour. Details at gpbnews.org. Well, it's been another long week. We've talked about the ceaseless wonders of marriage and how it can change your personality. We've talked about the devastating E. coli outbreak linked to romaine lettuce. Also talked about some long extinct southern parakeets. There used to be parakeets around here. So as we do every week, we've assembled a group of smart people to help us make sense of what the heck happened this week. It is time for the break room.
Boopity scoop. Scoopity whoop. Whoopity scoop.
Yes, kiddos, this is who you're getting tonight. We're at a Hilton. It's not nice. Trump is president. It's not ideal.
And
a healthy appreciation for the Second Amendment, sir.
We're going to get along just fine.
Joining us in the break room to talk about those stories and more is Natalie Pavelski, Vice President of Cater Communications, Greg Williams, host of the online radio show Greg's List, Decatur-based author Nikki Salcedo, and Kennesaw State University psychology professor Roxanne Donovan. Happy Friday to you all.
Happy morning. Friday.
Good morning.
All right, so series of tweets by rap artist Kanye West has left a lot of people wondering what's up with Yeezy. A few weeks ago, we tweeted about his new album that drops in June. That same week, he posted a photo wearing a red Trump MAGA hat. And this past week, he popped up on TMZ Live offering this opinion.
When you hear about slavery for 400 years, for 400 years, that sounds like a choice. Like, you was there for 400 years and it's all of y'all?
Okay, people of color on the panel, care to give us your thoughts?
Where to begin? The problem is he has 28 million Twitter followers who some might actually care what he has to say. And this is what comes out of his mouth, which is a very familiar narrative that enslaved people were somehow complicit in their own bondage. I think it's ahistorical. I think it's problematic. And I think he needs to read a book.
Okay. Roxanne, what do you think?
That was me.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I think we just heard.
As people know, I am in Macon, and y'all are in Atlanta, and I'm doing my best. Nikki, what do you think?
I think there's a great irony in someone speaking about enslavement working for the media and entertainment industry and not realizing that he is in another type of bondage. And, you know, I hope he focuses on his own physical and mental health. I'm not really overly concerned with his comments, and I hope his fans also realize.
Greg, as a conservative political commentator, what do you think looking at Kanye West in a MAGA hat? Do you think, oh my, what a great defection to my side? Or do you think, well, why don't you stay over there?
You know, it's funny. Conservatives usually say, well, let's not pay any attention to these celebrities. They don't know what the heck they're talking about. And then as soon as one or two come over to our side, they're like, look at this guy. He's awesome. Make America Kanye again. And it's kind of... it's a bit duplicitous on our part. What I was most excited about Kanye West tweeting was quotes from Thomas Sowell, though. These were very good economic quotes, and that's my contribution to the commentary today. Is let's focus on his Thomas Sowell quotes, and hopefully he'll be able to bring some black folks over to the Republican Party in 2020.
Yeezy is nothing if not a Renaissance man. Let's talk about another controversial musician. R. Kelly has been in the limelight a lot recently. For years, I mean, for a long time, we've known about allegations of sexual abuse against him, largely involving underage girls. But for some reason, these just allegations haven't really ended his career yet. The Time's Up movement is trying to make that happen, finally, asking RCA, Kelly's label, to drop him. They also want streaming services like Apple Music and Spotify to remove R. Kelly's songs. The movement campaigns under the hashtag Mute Kelly. Natalie, do you think time's up finally for R. Kelly?
Well, he's been in a slide for a while now, and this is not going to help. But will it end it? I'm just not sure. I mean, he's still able to keep playing concerts despite years and years of allegations against him. Some people are still buying tickets.
Yeah. Anybody else think time's up for R. Kelly?
I mean, with the technology these days, you can almost produce an album or MP3 on your own. You don't need to have a major record label. You can distribute it through social media. So is his career over? No. The record labels may drop him, but he can easily produce his own music and his own concerts without the help of RCA.
His time is up. This is Nikki. I refuse to boycott anything ever. If everyone will boycott everything, I just stay the course. But R. Kelly is the one where I draw the line. We should not support him or his music. You know, his crimes are great and have been in secret and slowly coming out. So if there's a way for us to take his money away, it takes away his power to influence and keep captive these young women.
Right.
And I couldn't agree with Nikki more.
Let's try to sneak in one more topic before the break here. Michelle Wolf, the comedian at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, is at the center of a controversy. A lot of people found her routine to be beyond the pale, especially remarks about Trump's press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Here's a clip.
I actually really like Sarah. I think she's very resourceful. Like, she burns facts, and then she uses that ash to create a perfect smoky eye. Like, maybe she's born with it. Maybe it's lies. It's probably lies.
Too far?
Well, look, that's, you know, I would hate to be Sarah Huckabee Sanders in that situation, but being shocked at Michelle Wolf's routine is like going to the Cheetah Lounge and being shocked to find scantily clad women on stage. I mean, that's Michelle Wolf's rep. And the White House Correspondents Association dinner is always a roast setup, and the comedian always gets in trouble. It happened in this administration. It happened in the Obama administration. It happened in the Bush administration. This is no great surprise.
Yeah, well, not being a snowflake, I was not offended by the remarks. I thought they should have had a rebuttal segment, though, where kind of like James Corden's Drop the Mic, where they give Sarah a chance to retort, and she could say something like, hey, Michelle Wolf, Debbie Wasserman Schultz called. She wants her wig back.
Well, they used to have the president do the rebuttal. I mean, during the Obama administration,
that's a good point. Exactly,
that was Trump has decided not to do it.
Precisely, that was functionally the response, kind of like the response to the minority response to the State of the Union. But without the president there, it is a very different gig indeed. All right, we got to take a break. Just ahead, Break Room Gang going to weigh in on Brian Kemp's controversial new political ad. He's running for governor in Georgia and pointed a shotgun at a teenager on television. That and more stories coming up. It's on Second Thought. It's on Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. We're continuing our weekly break room panel with our folks talking about the week's news. Natalie Pavelski is with us. She's vice president of Cater Communications. Greg Williams, host of the conservative online radio show Greg's List, is with us. Nikki Salcedo, Decatur-based author. Also Roxanne Donovan, psychology professor at Kennesaw State University. Let's talk about the big talker topic in Georgia this week. Republican Secretary of State Brian Kemp drawing attention with his new ad as he's running for governor. This ad shows him holding and I think cleaning a shotgun while his daughter's boyfriend, or at least within the fictional world of the ad, it's his daughter's boyfriend. I don't know if it's really the guy, but a gentleman, a young man in a very, very nice plaid suit, shirt, is saying that he wants to date Brian Kemp's daughter. And Brian Kemp then rattles off some pet peeves and asks some, let's call them, loaded questions.
Two things if you're going to date one of my daughters.
Respect.
And?
A healthy appreciation for the Second Amendment, sir.
We're going to get along just fine.
Brian Kemp for governor.
Yes, that click was the sound of the shotgun pointed at the young man. Nikki, what do you make of this?
It's disappointing. And, you know, I'm actually fine with this ad being on the air because the constituents will need to decide. And it reveals more about the psyche of the candidate and our current climate. And I hope voters are able to respond to what they've seen here. So it's a tricky one.
It is a joke, right?
Does not seem very funny to me. And I'm waiting to find someone who thinks it's funny on either side.
Yeah, this is Natalie. I mean, especially given the Parkland shooting, an ad featuring a grown man pointing a gun towards a high school student, and then there's assault-style weapons in the background, like props. I mean, this is tone deaf on the verge of disgusting to me.
Yeah, I agree. It was really sad to see. I saw it for the first time yesterday, just kind of walking in, and I froze watching it. And I'm thinking Parkland, I'm thinking Pulse, not to mention the patriarchal subtext that's equally ridiculous. It's just hard. But yeah, the voters get to decide because he gets to put this on the air because I believe stations are prohibited from rejecting ads from candidates and they have to play it as it's given to them. So
within certain obvious constraints. Right. Yeah. But Greg Williams, all of Georgia wants to know.
Do I get the last word?
I think we're going to talk about this for a while. But what does Greg Williams make of the Brian Kemp pointing a shotgun at a teenager ad?
Well, I am supporting one of Kemp's opponents, Hunter Hill, for governor. I will say that the angle of the camera, that he was not actually pointing the gun. So let's just at the child.
That's where you're going to go, Greg.
Forensic analysis concludes.
This is CSI Atlanta going right now. So as far as the tone of it, you know, the problem with primary elections is you get about a 10 to 15% turnout rate of voters. And unfortunately, they tend to skew either very left or very right. And you end up having to kind of cater your ads towards that group. And then after the primaries, both candidates, whoever wins, it'll be Stacey Abrams on the Democrat side. And then I do think Hunter Hill will be our nominee. They'll come back towards the middle. It's just politics 101, political science. So So this was it's grabbed a lot of attention from Brian Kemp. I think it's probably going to be a successful name ID building campaign. Mm-hmm. And I think it's probably going to help him in the Republican primary.
Yeah, very good real politic analysis. But let's get back to the sort of moral analysis. I mean, look, both parties in my lifetime have drifted in all kinds of ways. So I don't want to single out the Republican Party. But it's just notable to me that, you know, 10 million years ago when I was a Boy Scout, they gave us like a rifle safety guide that was produced by the NRA. And like the thing on number one was, as I recall, never, ever point a gun at somebody you don't intend to shoot. And this just seems like setting a bad example, don't you think, Greg?
Well, again, nobody was in the room when it was being filmed. It was not being pointed at him. So, I don't think that we should be pointing guns at people during campaign ads, if that's what you guys all agree. I think we can all agree.
Thank you.
I have changed my position, okay? Now I'm anti-Second Amendment, according to the forum.
No. Glaring at him right now.
I can never run for office in Georgia after that statement now. I'm doomed. I just killed my career.
All righty. Anybody have any last thoughts on Brian Kemp?
We've reached a new nadir. A new low point.
We've reached
a low point and then we dig ourselves further down.
All righty then. Moving on. Hey, look at this. There's a rule in journalism writing, avoid cliches, but here I go. Peacocks, pigs, hamsters, oh my. Airlines keep seeing exotic pets that their owners want to pass off as service animals just hanging out in the cabin. Both Delta and Alaska Airlines have tightened their regulations for transporting pets as service animals lately. The Americans with Disabilities Act defines service animals to be dogs or even miniature horses that are trained to help people with disabilities. This has caused a lot of fuss at airports. What do we think should be done about creature trying to pass off? Let's take out all the people who have legitimate service animals, because I'm sure there are a lot of people who have legitimate service animals, and those animals are unusual. They seem weird to people. But let's talk specifically about the people who are trying to pass off their pet, trying to pass off Muffy as a service dog, just so that they don't have to pay the fee to put Muffy in the back with all of the luggage. How do the airlines handle this? Do we really want our airlines making, you know, untrained airline employees making decisions about who and about what is and is not a legitimate service animal? Anybody?
Well, you know, they haven't been making tough decisions. When somebody shows up at the airport with a peacock, it's a pretty easy decision. And
I'm not a doctor. I don't know that. Seriously, it's weird. What science tells us is that reality is often counterintuitive, and maybe there is somebody with a legit peacock service animal.
Well, you don't want to mention the people with legitimate needs, but the more people who violate the policy, more often impact the people with legitimate needs. And so if we're going to care for those who actually need it, the people who violate it need to go to jail. If you light a cigarette in an airplane, you go to jail. If you cause a disturbance on the airplane, you go to jail. If you bring in your chihuahua, who's really just your best friend and not helping you in any way, you should go to jail.
Yeah. The last time we flew, my wife tried to bring her service husband on board for a free ticket, but we got shown pretty quickly that I was going to have to pay for my ticket too. But if you have a service peacock, I think you probably need to start driving. All sorts of bird allergies and some of these things are getting ridiculous. I was at Pont City Market a couple months ago, and basically everybody's just throwing a yellow sash on their dog and bringing their dog in. So as a service animal, just so they could walk around the mall with it. And that's really taking away from the people that genuinely need the companionship, either for security or for if it's a blind person, that it can help guide them through the thing. And I think it's dissipating that missive completely.
Especially when there are limits to how many animals you can have in the cabin. Like, you can't have, 70 dogs in a plane. There's a definite limit.
And service animals are trained. They are trained not to respond in stressful environments. And so when you just slap a yellow thing on your mini poodle because you want, and I have mini poodles, so this isn't to say that mini poodles are horrible, but you slap this yellow thing on a mini poodle and then they react or they bite or they're disruptive. That's a problem for everyone in the cabin. So this is an altogether ridiculous thing that's happening. Like, people please.
Well, Roxanne, as the psychology professor, I think we should give you the last word on that. let's see. Let's move on to modesty ponchos.
Oh, Lord.
High school dress codes can get a little bit convoluted.
Okay, here is how we're gonna do things. No backless hoodies, no collarbone cardigans, toeless boots, pelvis-high skirts, tube tops, tops made out of tubing, no fishnet bodysuits,
what?
No hat outfits, and no jeggings. Now, are we clear?
Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
A Michigan Catholic high school has gotten backlash after offering female students what they called modesty ponchos. These ponchos will be issued to students who do not follow the dress code for the school's prom. The theology teacher who came up with the idea says it will help students to focus on their inner beauty. I like focusing on inner beauty. People on the panel who aren't me or Greg want to comment on this one.
You are so smart to call
Thank
on
you.
The women first. This is Natalie, and I'm speaking as somebody who went through 12 years of ridiculously sexist Catholic schools where the girls had to wear ugly plaid and the guys could just wear nice-looking jackets. Look, this is what I don't like here. I mean, schools have the right to require dress codes, but what I hate here is the focus on girls' bodies, as if a dress with a low back is somehow some kind of scandal, and as if you're shaming the girl. I mean, let the kids dress up and have a good time, and if somebody shows a little cleavage, it's not like they haven't seen it before.
Well,
Go ahead.
I love the modesty poncho, because if you've actually recently seen a prom dress, it's not the cleavage you have to worry about. The backs are out, the sides are out, the slits are cut up, so I'd like modesty chaps. I'd like a modesty cummerbund, a modesty vest for the sides. And really, just don't have prom. Yeah, quit prom. If you can't, just let the girls dress the way they want. Some will be conservative and some will be sexy. It's okay.
We are talking about children here, though, right? There is an in loco parentis function.
Yeah, the modesty poncho is like the modern day scarlet letter, right? So you're basically here, wear this to cover yourself. I saw last night I posted something. They are now making legless jeans. I don't know if you guys
saw that.
$168 for jeans with no legs, but they do have pockets. So that probably deserves a modesty poncho.
Think that's called a utility belt.
I think there's a real problem with policing women's bodies and our society's discomfort with women's sexuality. And we need to have a conversation about that. And this modesty poncho is not the answer. The answer is allowing women to express themselves in whatever way they feel comfortable. And the real problem is sexual assault and sexual violence against
100%.
Girls and women.
All righty. Another touchy issue having to do with sexuality and women being objectified. Charlie Rose, this will be of interest to people, fans of public media. Charlie Rose has been discussed as a possible host of a new series in which he would interview men who, like him, were recently brought to judgment by the hashtag MeToo movement. Rose faces a number of allegations of sexual misconduct from former staffers. Those cost him his job both as host of the Charlie Rose Show on PBS not too long ago, and also his job hosting one of those network early morning shows. I can never remember which one. And a whole lot more allegations about him came out this week, coming out at the same time. That, reportedly someone is considering giving Charlie Rose a show in which he would talk to other men who have been Me Too'd. I'm guessing people on the panel think this is a bad idea, but would anyone join me in admitting that you would so listen to it?
I would. This is Nikki. I'd be curious, because is it a show about men making excuses, which I would not want to watch? Is it a show about men, understanding the impact of what they did and speaking thoughtfully? That would be interesting. I don't think that would happen. But, what's the actual intent of the show? I would want to know.
Yeah.
And I would suspect it's the former more than the latter, right? So I'm not tuning in. I don't see in any world where it's okay to give a platform to individuals who have been accused of sexual assault and sexual harassment. And I think Charlie Rose needs to really be reflective about what he's doing and to disappear, frankly, from the public eye and do some soul searching. That might be a much better way for him to spend his time than to try to go through the slog of getting back into the media eye in any way, shape, or form.
Oh, I thought they were going to bring out surprise guests.
If the show's set in a courtroom, I'm probably good with it, right?
Well, who's going to advertise on it? The Today Show without Matt Lauer? Jell-O?
Well, if they want Jell-O pudding too soon? If they wanted to go for a listener-supported model, I think there's a number of men out there who congregate in certain corners of the internet.
Harvey Weinstein could produce it.
No, you've got a point, Adam. I think there might be people who actually tune in because they believe these men are getting short shrift in some way. And that, I think, is part of the problem, right?
Yeah. Well, it's been interesting to me, Greg, to watch a lot of these men fight so hard not just to redeem themselves, not just to fight against on a factual basis, saying that they're innocent, but also just to get back their position in the limelight, right? Which is a totally different thing from simply being absolved. And I do wonder if all of this is part of some broader personality disorder or pathology among people, frankly, like you and me, people who like to talk over the air for a living, that are we all just a little bit too addicted to attention of various kinds?
Well, I think it's, you know, addicted to attention as being a talking head or a spokesperson or a mouthpiece. But it's also that's how they make money. Right. So you're, you know, if they don't have another source of income, Charlie Rose is probably old enough to start getting Social Security now. But,
yeah, I don't think Charlie Rose is hurting. You know, but some of these Matt Lauer,
some of these younger Matt Lauer may not be hurting. But I mean, now that there's all this potential litigation out there, a $10 million fortune can disappear very quickly. So I think that's what they're worried about more, is what they're going to do afterwards, if they're going to be able to pay their penance to society and to the women that they've hurt over the years, what the next step is for them. And I'm sure that's a concern.
All right. We're out of time, but real quick, what's everybody doing over the weekend? Natalie Pavelski of Cater Communications.
Two play dates and a May Day celebration for the kid. Yes, I'm a mommy.
Right there with you. Greg Williams of the radio show Greg's List.
Tonight looks like an amazing time to have some drinks on a patio. And then tomorrow is not only the Kentucky Derby, it's Cinco de Mayo. So we have a full boat of activities tomorrow. I haven't even looked at what horse I'm going to bet on. Yeah. I'm sure that's controversial here because we don't want to use animals for sport in this room either now, do we?
Well. Regardless, strap in Greg's liver. Nikki Salcedo, Decatur-based author. What you doing this weekend?
Well, today is May the 4th, so I'm going to enjoy some Star Wars today. May the 4th be with all of you.
And
always. And, you know, hopefully I'll sneak out to Infinity War one more time. And I have four kids, so that means I have about 13 soccer games. See you on the field.
Kennesaw State University professor Roxanne Donovan, what you up to this weekend?
If I can get to see Infinity Wars, I would be so happy. And my 9-year-old is doing a dance show, and there's 3 performances on Saturday. Just wish me luck. I'll survive this.
All right, that's it for our show today. Thanks to everybody. Listeners, we want to hear from you. How about that Brian Kemp campaign ad where he points a shotgun, either literally or perhaps merely through a trickery of camera angles, points a shotgun at a teenager? What do you think about that? Give us a call, 404-500-9457, or you can also post to our Twitter. We're at OST Talk, or to our Facebook page. For On Second Thought, I'm Adam Ragusea. Have yourself a great weekend.